We'll proceed with our regular agenda. Please note that because we're just a tad late, the last session may not happen, but Harold will still come up and give some comments.
Okay,
no, there's no time left. Like William said, the speaker for the next the cyber social event is here. So even though we're a few minutes late, it's not that bad. So our next presenter will be Dr. Harold Bowley, who will discuss the Open RuleML standard for semantic web rule interchange. Dr. Bowley is an adjunct professor at the Faculty of Computer Science, University of New Brunswick, and a leader of the Semantic Web Laboratory at NRC IIT eBusiness. So. With our organization. He's been with us for about 2 years now. 2 years. Came on board, interestingly enough, as a guest worker from Germany. So I spoke early on about that we regularly have about 1,000 guest workers per year from outside the organizations. Harold was a guest worker from one of the AI research labs in Germany. His current focus is semantic web knowledge representation using POSL and object-oriented RuleML.
So, rules are essential for the semantic web, and rule interchange in an open format is important for e-business. RuleML is the de facto standard for rule interchange and markup, and it's being developed conjointly with a number of standards bodies, including W3C and ONG. So RuleML enables basically rule interchange in XML, but you can also do rule modeling, markup, translation, execution, publication, archiving in UML RDF ASCII because you have translators between these languages. And these are only different variations of the same underlying structure of rules. RuleML identifies explicit languages for derivation rules which extend SQL views, which are now also recursive, and reaction rules which extend SQL triggers to empower those sub-communities of these sub-languages defined by the sub-languages. We use UML to model the sub-languages, and you will see rectangles for the actual sub-languages and ovals for elementary modules, and let me immediately skip to that. We have this hierarchy. We have a very special type of use, namely binary relations are only allowed in this dialogue. So if you are in this sub-language, you are only allowed to use binary relations. Here you have NRE relations and elementary data, like in a relational model. Then you can proceed to complex domains and get a phone logic. Then this equality and reason to be moved upward to full first order logic. These always give you some extra vocabulary for that XML language. And we have inheritance hierarchy as indicated by the standard UML modeling. And UML specifies derivation rules in XML schema. We started with CTPs but now proceeded to XML schema. All sub-languages have recently been released in this version of RuleML, including also an object-oriented extension. And as I mentioned, this first-order logic RuleML has very recently been released by the Joint Committee. We collaborate with this Joint Committee also on the semantic web rule language, which was released in the newest version as a package together with RuleML. Because in the semantic web, you basically have ontologies which consist of taxonomies which can be described in Swirl and rules which can be described in RuleML. Now let's look at one example of a policy rule. In particular, this business rule is about discounts. It's a ternary relation. The discount for a customer buying a product is 5%, provided the customer is premium and the product is regular. So this is an implication rule where the conclusion is this ternary relation of the discount between two variables, customer and product, and one individual constant, 5%, provided is in the body a conjunction of two atomic formulas, premium must hold for customer and regular must hold for this product variable. So that's basically an XML tree applied to such RuleML rules. And if you want to see the correspondence between this tree and the markup, it's very much like a parse tree. And the XML shows you all of these non-terminals So you have to split this root in start implies, end implies, then you have the head and the body of the root. Inside you have the atomic formulas, and the color coding can show you how to go backward and forward. And notice that the left to right order is important. For instance, the three arguments of this count are ordered left to right. It's positional.
Now, recently we have proceeded to a slotted version of RuleML.
In that version, the order of the left to right arguments no longer is relevant because you label the arcs by buyer, item, and rebate in this case, so you can then commute them. Actually, we already did it on the system level for head and body because some communities want to mention the condition first, the body of the rule, and then the conclusion in the head. So we labeled this already, but now also on the user level of these relations, buyer, item, and rebate. And so slots are now also inside such relations. You can see the individual constant, which is the name of the slot, and customer is a filler, and rebate is another name, and 5% is another filler. So we have these slots now inside user relations. That's a new part of the slotted RuleML, which is itself a part of object orientation, that you center the information around those relational objects. The initiative has a steering committee and technical groups concerned with reaction rules, for instance, and ontology combination. I mentioned this semantic web rule language, and we have more than 40 participants, including companies such as IBM, Sun, Oracle, and Sybase. We work with standard bodies, WCC. We had this member submission, and you can click on all of this. You will find we have the submission of Swirl, ONG. We are part of two responses to requests for proposals, one on the systematic of business rules and the other on production rules, which are very much like these reaction rules I mentioned, these trigger extensions. We work with OASIS, a technical committee is being planned for policy RuleML. Governments and RuleML, DARPA, this is a joint committee with an archive discussion list where you can see what we are being discussing in a heated manner. NRC, IIT hosts the portal RuleML.org through mailing list, including RuleML all, and look there. CISTI leads the team for the real submission to WCC, and IRAP evaluates real-world use scenarios.
DFKI, my German affiliate, 2 years ago started this RuleML hosting. RuleML 087 is a complete release, full schema, you can find it here.
I mentioned the RuleML model. We have a new way to do the Stripes, namely this alternating type role tag business, which is also very important for relational databases and RDF.
The validation is now quite okay. First order logic RuleML 0.9 that was released only on the 4th of November. It's only a preliminary first specification using a monolithic VTD, and you can find that here. I might ask that we have now a full first order logic, which means we have explicit for all an exist quantifier if we like, and we can have disjunctive information, so we can have the OR in the head. Also we have classical negation and equivalence, and this new version will benefit all other sublanguages of RuleML 0.9, which is forthcoming. So I mentioned also execution of rules, and JRU is one engine to execute RuleML, Java Deductive Reasoning Engine for the web by Bruce Spencer. You can find information about here. It's open on SourceForge, and it does top-down and bottom-up execution of RuleML rule bases. Our JRU, I mentioned these slotted extensions, was done as an engine by Marcel Wohl. And it comes with applets, both top-down and bottom-up, and you can download the chart files. It has all RuleML for input, and it's now used for most of the new applications. Here they are. We have done rule-applying agents for comparison shopping, learning object comparison. We had actually a project with Rod, and collaborative filtering, and this led to the new indiscover.net portal. It's about independent music discovery. You can find MP3 files, and you can rate those, and you can upload your own ones if you are a musician. NBBISKB, it's a new Brunswick business knowledge base, uses our RuleML for both data validation and integration. If you click here, you find another talk
about that use on data integration, which is a real business need. You have so many legacy databases, you need to integrate the data with different schemas, and rules can help here, like the views of SQL system. Asian Matcher is a system for matchmaking, and it can be used for e-learning. Metadata are being interchanged in Asian Matcher using weighted or OpenML, where the slots can carry weights of importance, the relative importance of those slots for the entire relation. Techlantic, it's for profile of startup projects. For Atlantic companies, startup companies, and also business angels, venture capitalists, and it's about technology transfer. Using such descriptions, again, it employs weighted or OpenML, and colleagues of mine and other folks have been working more with the direction rule ML part. Conclusions. There will be a more human-readable syntax called Puzzle. The web rules and open source communities should learn more from each other. And there's a nice article by Kendall Clark criticizing that there is not quite enough collaboration, even though WCC's works are very much in the field of open source, and they want to experiment with real software and so on, and he is starting a nice discussion. And now I would ask you to give input if you have interest in that. And I'm not quite happy with features. Give your input for our work towards the release of Room at 1.0 towards mid next year. Thank you.
Thank you, Harold.
So when I asked Harold to make sure he didn't go overtime, he made sure of the opposite, right? Any questions for Harold? Regarding rule ML and applications, and
is your presentation and the links going to be available somewhere?
Should be.
Yeah. On the CyberSocial web, you'll probably have them on. Are you going to post them on your website also?
Yeah.
I think we're going to have them on the CyberSocial.ca site.
That if Harold gives permission.
Yes, I guess.
Well, Stephen can work that out.
Yeah.
But RuleML.
He can express them.
RuleML.org is the basic website.
Yes.
Soon, check the cybersocial.ca site, because it looks like we're going to be able to do it there.
If not, we'll find another place like Stephen's website, or they're going to be...
Type in RuleML to Google and press it.
There was another question behind there, behind Harold, no? On RuleML?
When you look at RuleML and you look at Atlantic Canada, do any natural partners from industry come to mind for you?
Yeah, e-learning companies and knowledge management companies come to mind. If you're interested in ontologies in the semantic web, and definitely RuleML is a markup language for the rules part of ontologies. I try to sketch that ontologies consist of taxonomies, hierarchical structures, like in object-oriented modeling, and rules operating on those structures. So, and the rules part can be handled with RuleML.
Could you comment on how you could use RuleML to format objects to re-represent them into a new environment? Also, perhaps to do data filtering, data coming from one source, you want to apply some sort of rule so that not all the data is presented to everybody in a presentation layer, etc. Things like this. How can you apply this in a middleware scenario?
The first language of choice would, of course, be XSLT, WCC standard for such kinds of transformation. Now in RuleML, we could do it with this relational sub-language where it's this ternary discount relation, because it's actually transformation what you are talking about. You transform one document, say an XML document, to another one, and release can simulate such transformations by having extra argument for the output. That's one way to reduce functions which reduce an input to an output to a relation with one extra argument for the output. In that way, you could simulate transformations using relations, but we are also working on a direct functional sub-language for RuleML. I did not make a lot of progress because I was so much involved in the OO and FOL extensions, but it's really my topic. My real topic is functional programming and logic combined. And this is what you mentioned, transformation also of XML trees. would be the functional part, and we are working on that. But still, we would then translate it to XSLT, and I did not mention, even not in the slide, that the point of such a standard language is once you have one XML language, you can translate it to another one using XSLT. So we could, for instance, transform these functional rules in RuleML to XSLT and say run it then directly in XSLT. If you want a universal interchange format for all kinds of rules, you should look at RuleML. If you know you only want XSLT-like transformations, then stick to that.
Do you have any examples of where this can be or has been used in the business world?
In the business world?
Second application is about the business world, and it captures information coming from two source databases, one from Business New Brunswick and the other from Yahoo. And you can go to that talk to see how we try to integrate source. And I mentioned information integration is a big topic for industry. Because of all of these legacy databases, you try to migrate some information. If you have 100, like big companies easily have, then you try to get rid of maybe 50 by having integration views. Initially, you do it dynamically, and slowly you can try to abolish the old ones if you have migrated everything over to this new view. So that would be an application. And I mentioned Cy Tabit. He started a company called Inference Web Incorporated in Boston, and he uses RuleML for compliance in financial service business. And I can bring you in contact with it if you're interested. That's a startup company built around RuleML, actually. And there is also another company in the UK that's called Enigma Tech, and Enigma Tech is also be interested in RuleML very much and used reaction rules in particular, because these are like these event condition action rules that are of high interest also to industry.
So those are decision support systems then?
Yes.
And real expert systems?
Yeah, and in real world, in real-time environment, if you have reaction rules, it's decision support in a real-time environment. The derivation rules, which we discussed here, were offline, so to speak. We do some business analysis and integrate existing databases without having trigger events coming from the real world. That's the derivation rule part. But the reaction rule part takes triggers and events from the outside world.
The problem is this for improving search engines too.
Yes.
With the weighting and stuff, if I type in two or three phrases, I can say this one is important, this one is of little importance.
Yes, you can get a ranked list with these weights.
And if you look at the InDiscover website, it's based on technology called RACOFI, which is rule applying collaborative filtering technologies. So it is used in order to, you know, it can capture user preferences, and if I like it and you like this song and you like the other song, what's the likelihood that I'm going to like this song, even though I haven't listened to it? So in terms of predictive quality of parts of these algorithms, as they are used. Yes. That's the InDiscover website there. Any other questions? All right, thanks a lot, Harold. Next presenters will be René Richard and Dr. Keith Wilson, also from the Institute for Information Technology, but from our e-health research group based in St. John. They will discuss ongoing advances in creating an electronic patient record system for New Brunswick with open source tools and components. René is a key developer within our e-health research group, and he focuses on strategy and architecture for patient record systems, mainly for here in New Brunswick, but also across Canada. And Dr. Wilson completed a PhD in psychology at the University of Aberdeen and a medical degree from Memorial University. So he's a true Commonwealth participant. And he also has his own practice management software company called HealthNet Canada. So so are they in?
They're in.
Sorry.
It's on the
cyber social.
Well, welcome. I guess I'll introduce the topic a little bit as Renee gets her presentation sort of set up there. As Rod said, that I'm EP in St. John. I have a research interest and background. And, well, okay, I have ADD, I think. You know, play cello and symphony, blah, blah, blah. But one of my biggest interests is sort of the linkage of IT to healthcare. And a unique opportunity, of course, arose when NRC rolled into town with the e-health group sort of housed partly out of St. John. And I worked down the street, so it was kind of interesting to meet Verlet Harrop, who's our group leader, who couldn't be here today. And Renee, who's an absolute gem of an asset at the NRC, the two of us are sort of working together, developing sort of a first rollout of personal health record architecture. I'll talk a bit more about the concepts of a PHR in a little bit. Renee's going to talk a bit more about open source initially. And then we'll talk about where we're going. And unlike some of the other projects that have been discussed today, ours were at a very early stage. So keep that in mind as we're talking. I suspect that it'll generate a few comments, questions, lots of sticky issues, and big brother question sort of thing. And what we'll try and do is we'll try and wrap it up with a sort of a dropping a big hint on how industry and whatnot could potentially become involved in this project, which is hopefully going to be national and international in scope. So I'll let Renee talk a little bit. And do you want me to flip sides for you?
Sure. So since this is, can you guys hear me? Okay, since this is on open source, I figured I'd go on the internet and find the most popular. Description of open source, and just to get familiar. I didn't use open source. I worked for a big corporation, data center out in Nova Scotia, for a while, and we never used open source. And I started working at NRC. It's a bit more liberal. We can install what we want. I'm a CS there. I do a lot of the purchasing, okay? And people purchasing in the government is hard. So the first thing we do when we need to find a solution is we go to, Fresh Meat, SourceForge. Because usually what we do is we'll try to find something that will meet the needs, and most, like 80% of the time, you find what you need and you don't have to purchase it. So that's where I'm coming from. anyways, I read this book when I worked in Calgary on my Palm Pilot when I was commuting. And this guy, Eric Raymond, has anybody heard about this book? Yeah, so I won't talk too much about it. This guy, a bit controversial, but I think it was the Free Software Foundation he helped found, or he's heavily involved in that anyways, but he had a need that he wanted to address a certain need that he had, and he went online trying to find a free solution, couldn't find one, and so he grabbed this one piece of software called, I think, Pop Clients or something, and turned it into FetchMail, and he all along his developments, he sort of chronicled what happened and what the open source environment was like and whatnot. So he came up with the idea that the closed source was like a cathedral environment where you've got a lot of little groups building these cathedrals. And it's a closed environment. You've got experts in their fields, but they don't really talk to others and share ideas. And then the open source, which is like a free-for-all. People contribute, they take. That's what he talks about there. He draws some conclusions on that favorite open source model. this is a talk on open source, so there's negative issues around open source. I'm aware of that. You know, everything has a cost, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But also, I want to help talk about open source a little bit. Okay, so the bizarre environments, characteristics of the bizarre environments, is the development is done by the user of the software. Usually the user of the software has an itch that they need to scratch, and that's what drives them to find a solution. And usually the solution is very good for what they want because it's, they have a vested interest in solving. And the user slash developers, they prioritize the functionality of the software. And usually the developers, they choose the work assignments, so they actually pick what they want to work on. And they have many iterations of, or many ways of finding solutions to these problems. So a lot of code samples or solutions to a given problem to pick from. So usually you pick the better one and go from there. And then technical discussions are open and encouraged. So that's the bizarre environment. The cathedral environment is it's more of a closed environment. Developers are not the users. They don't really care about the product as much. Usually the functionality is determined by product managers or marketing, right? And then usually managers assign the work assignments to these individuals, these coders. And usually it's a, you know, it's a business environment. They want to find a solution to the problem really quickly and efficiently. So you don't get that many iterations, or they're not as encouraged of ways to solve the problem. And technical discussions are closed to a broader audience, so you don't get the feedback you would get from other people. Okay, I have a degree in economics, so I'm going to use it now. manufacturers, when they suggest a retail price, what they achieve by this is they actually try to get the companies that are selling your product to compete on service, because if the price is the same, you can, you know, you're going to compete on service if you want to sell the product. Well, open source sort of does the exact same thing. Or it, there's no price to for the software. So for the consumer, they benefit from the fact that people compete on service. So and it also provides greater competitions as the entry-level companies who provide extra services, they can participate in the market. You know, there's no entry barriers. Okay, this is the application server that we're going to be using for the personal health record. It's called JBoss. And I put this on there because this really struck a chord with me. It says, spend your money on knowledge, not licenses. So the whole focus around open source is, you know, to get to the starting block, you don't have to pay X amount of money as a software shop. You just download the tools, pick the tools you need, and then maybe you need to make some investments, but they're not on licenses. So, and again, this is the last little point I'm going to make, is it's important to note that like zero license cost doesn't assume zero like implementation costs, right? The fact that you're choosing JBoss as an application server doesn't mean that you can get up and going in your development right away. Everything you choose to do or not to do has a cost associated to it. So I think that's my part.
Oh, we'll come back to this in a little bit, actually.
Yeah.
Thanks, Renee. I guess now what I'm going to do is trying to convince all of you of the value of a personal health record. Essentially, I don't know why that's a little off, but anyway, in the spectrum of healthcare management, especially in the Canadian context with a single payer, we have a number of different repositories of health information across that spectrum. We have institutions such as hospitals managing a wild amount of data, and your tertiary care centers. You get corporations, like larger corporations like Irving and McCain's and whatnot, that are starting to manage a whole bunch of health data of their own employees within the context of an organization. And then you get community groups that manage a whole bunch of health data as well, for individuals as well as groups. And then you get a little old person that is going into the healthcare system and utilizing all of these services, that are keeping a little journal at home in Word, saying that I had a headache today. This is what I took for it, and I got better. Okay, not quite like that. Anyway, but basically, part of the problem is that across that continuum of health information, it's in silos. And there isn't a lot of good sharing going on of the information. And what's interesting about that whole problem is that who ultimately is the beneficiary and owner of that data? Well, it's the individual. Unfortunately, though, there are so many barriers out there with the way the record systems are set up that it becomes impossible for the individual to become empowered with their own health data. And so what we are looking at here is that a personal health record, to a degree, and what our interest is in, is part of a shift from the acute intervention to a wellness model, okay, which focuses a lot of the information more towards the individual. Now, obviously, I'm not excluding institutions here, but the institutions and their electronic health records, like Canada Health Infoway, that's getting involved in creating a one-patient, one-record across the country, you've got to understand that what that is representing is the medical aspect of healthcare and wellness. Wellness in an individual's life is this big. Medical interventions might be only this much of what's going on. And so a personal health record tries to tap into that broader scope so that you actually get people engaged in their own health and health behaviors really early on, while they're still well. Okay? So essentially, what is a PHR? Well, a PHR, quite simply, is an electronic repository of health information. It has a number of characteristics which I'll just briefly touch on here. Comprehensiveness, obviously, from an individual's perspective, I want to have a single record that brings together all of the information about my health, and I want to control it. There, I'll just put these up and then I'll just talk to them. Accessibility and portability, obviously, is a vital component of any type of healthcare system, and that is the medical answer within Canada Health Infoway, is that if I am in St. John, New Brunswick, and I travel to Vancouver and end up in the emergency department, I want that emergency department doctor to be able to access my health information in New Brunswick that's relevant. Well, that is important, but that's not the be-all and end-all of healthcare. It's the medical part is not the be-all and end-all. And that's crazy, because it sounds like I'm threatening my own job security. But hey, I work for the NRC too, so I'm all set. But anyway, the portability factor, if I go to rural South Africa, which is another reason why I'm totally interested in the PHR, I'm interested in the international component. I want this portability to be there so that I can get access to my wellness information as opposed to just my medical information in the rural context. Let's say I go mountain climbing and I lose 10 pounds. Maybe I want to record that. You know, there's a disparity between what people think healthcare means and what it really truly means on a broader sense, because people are dealing with their own health on a day-to-day business. Like the choice of getting coffee right now, some of you are going to go home tonight and end up with reflux, you know, and heartburn and whatnot. Well, that's a health choice. You know, that has data surrounding it if you want to allow it to become part of that. Interoperability, obviously, in order to allow the flow of data from a number of different sources, we have to tap into the medical clinics. We have to tap into the pharmacies at the superstore, your food grocery lists at the superstore, for instance. And, you know, a lot of the messaging that happens on the internet from a healthcare perspective is happening using HL7. Well, our system needs to be able to talk this messaging system that will allow interoperability between a medical system and a personal health record system. Confidentiality, accountability. Well, obviously, people need to entrust their information somewhere to some data store. There's no such thing as a foolproof solution in terms of security. Well, people said the same thing 10 years ago about their banking, online banking. Oh my goodness, somebody's going to break in and I'm going to lose all my assets. Well, there's been the occasional breach, you know, called features. No, in the software. Sorry, that's a Microsoft business, isn't it? Sorry. And the thing is that we have, you know, we've learned how to adapt to the online banking thing and allowing that type of personal information to reside there on the net in a, you know, a more or less secure way. Well, it's the same idea with healthcare, except I'm sure it's to another level, and that's why security and whatnot is going to be such a big factor. But remember here, though, this is a personal health record system. You, as an individual, are going to be in control of your health data. Now, does that mean you can invent the fact that you're supposedly on Dilaudid, which is, you know, drug of choice in southern New Brunswick? Sure, you can fake that, but from an accountability perspective, in your personal health record, it will say that you authored this. So within the whole system, every identified user of the system, even automated processes, have an authentication component to it. And we're actually working with Service New Brunswick as a potential sort of authenticator to get the process started. Or not authenticator, sorry. And then obviously flexibility. My own take on the PHR, because I can skip over a few slides because I'm talking ad nauseum here. Anyway, with the flexibility component here, we don't know yet, A, whether people are going to be interested in an electronic model of their own health information. We don't know what kind of data people are going to be interested in storing. Now, I'll give you an example. A diabetic, for instance, is an excellent example of a type of citizen or patient that has been empowered with dealing with data on a day-to-day basis. They deal with blood glucoses and HbA1cs and creatinine levels and adjusting their insulin doses much better than we do as doctors. They're the ones that deal with the data on a day-to-day basis, and they manage their health with it. Well, they might be a potential, you know, I can picture them being kind of interested in stuff like this, especially when we add an e-learning component that will allow, you know, teaching, customized teaching to individuals based on the type of information that they've stored. But we don't want to limit it to these types of things. Part of the reason why NRC is involved in this is that obviously this is a big research initiative. We need to find out the who, why, what, when, how of what this is going to be. So I'll just quickly go over. In the United States, there are a number of personal health records in place already. A lot of these PHRs, though, are actual portals to health information that's being stored on a hospital server, for instance. So if you go and access that information at this hospital over here, never the twain shall meet, you have to log into this one, then you have to log into this one, then you have to log into this one. Well, that's not portable information. But they're calling it a personal health record. Our vision is a little different. And this is what sparked the interest of our group leader, Verlay Harrop, because she actually has her PhD from MIT and Harvard, where she met the gang at the Children's Hospital informatics program. And basically, they have created an open source back-end technology that acts as a data sponge. You can put any type of information you want in there. Now, their model, though, is designed to allow institution-to-institution exchange, but it's controlled by the individual. That is an excellent starting place. We looked at their software, and we've met with them. They've come up to visit us, and they've developed this architecture. But with the population that we're sort of looking at, like 34 million people, give or take a few billion, this is great, but it's not scalable. Scalability, obviously, is a big factor. And this software will reside on, like, one system and just doesn't scale. However, what we're interested in isn't so much the back end and how it works. We're interested in the how do things talk to this piece of software? So part of the open source technology that they've developed is this thing called PingTalk, which is an XML... let's skip that. Basically, PingTalk is an XML schema that says these are how you talk to PHR servers. Now, is this an international standard? Well, not yet, but, well, I guess it is now because we're using it in Canada, too, and they're using it in the States, so there you go, international standard. But we're going to be working as a group with the NRC to try and establish an international consortia that's going to look at the whole standards thing with respect to PHR. So we talked about the scalability. It needs to have a communication layer. One problem that I find with the Ping system is that in healthcare, telling stories or talking about your health or getting feedback on your health obviously is a very important part in dealing with health behavior. Getting feedback, that's why you go to your doctor instead of just looking on the internet, is that you need to get that interactivity there. So there needs to be a communications portion to this. So here's what we're planning on doing. We're going to be using PingTalk, and we're going to have as the language that's going to allow the accessibility. However, it is very limited in scope in a way, the way they do it, but they've allowed it enough flexibility that we can extend it to meet our needs. So we're going to add the communications layer. We're going to add the scalability, definitely, and a lot of the security stuff. And then we're looking at ways that this can be deployed in an international setting. Anyway, we're designing N-tier software for those interested. Now, the technologies that we're using are all open source, and for the geeks in the room, of course, we're using VI. Well, at least I'm using VI. But as a database, I mean, it's a pluggable architecture so that you can take, if you need that comfort level of knowing that Oracle is your back end, then yes, you can plug Oracle into this. We're not making it vendor specific or even open source technology specific. We are developing in an open source platform because that's what we believe in. We're using JBoss as an app server. We're using Apache and Tomcat. JetSpeed is our portal. We're building, after Christmas, a custom client thing that will allow you to be able to do anything. See, the thing about this that really excites me is that we don't know a lot of factors here. And what I'm hoping with the way that we're architecting this, this system, yes, exactly. We're building the substrate that a bunch of services and technologies can build on. Now, perhaps this is a bit magnanimous of me to say this, but back in the good old days when the internet was but a few universities connected together, you had the people that came up with the standards of how the protocols talked on the wire. Well, I can guarantee that despite the fact that HTML evolved on top of this layer, and you end up with web technologies, I bet you that the people that started that low-level stuff at the bottom there, I don't think that they would have predicted that we're able to listen to radio stations live from Brazil in real time, or video conferencing with our computer across the world. So what we're endeavoring to do is not to build the ultimate repository of health information per se, because we don't exactly know what it means to an individual. And so what we're building is we're building the substrate that will allow the organization and categorization of any type of information that a user may want to use, may want to store in a record. So how are we going to get people engaged in doing this? Well, part of the initiatives that we're looking at from an NRC perspective is we're looking at some opt-in possibilities for individuals to get into research. Canadians are well known for donating their time to research, donating their data to research. Classic example would be like Canada on the Move Step 1, which is a project, I think, of CIHR, where you donate your pedometer data to research and what engages you in healthy behaviors. So basically, we're building into this system a way for people to be able to opt into public health research, which is really quite exciting because it means limitless research opportunities. not in a Big Brother way, because one misconception about a PHR, especially when I talk to other physicians, is that, oh, well, it's great that you're going to have their medications, past medical history, allergies, past surgeries, and whatnot. You're going to have that in one place so that in the event of emergency, I, as Dr. X, can go in, break the glass, and have a look at it in the event of emergency. It's not the case. That is almost exactly the opposite of what we're trying to promote here. This is about personal health. You can opt to open up the access to, let's say I'm going to Vancouver. I'm going to open access to these emergency departments for this time period while I'm there in the event of an emergency. You are in control as an individual. The medical system is going to have its own medical data that will be able to be accessed in an emergency setting. The point is, this is personal health, so this is a little bit different. Part of the commercial possibility of this, and again, we're planting a seed here because it's a bit of a new concept to a lot of people in Canada. How do we get people into it? Well, Renee's going to talk in a second about Kwanka. We're doing a research project in St. John on independent at home, which is using the geriatrics department is looking at using PHR as a tool to help families, healthcare providers, and other service providers in the care of the elderly at home have a health record and the use of that. And that's going to be a research tool as well. Just before Renee speaks, I'll just mention one thing about the value-added idea here. There's a number of possibilities, and this is why I'm planting the seed now. There's a number of possibilities of how the PHR can be used in a sustainable way, and industry can become involved. On one small step, you can picture, obviously, a number of health portals opening up that will have a PHR portlet, for instance, sitting inside the health portal, and services are built around custom things based on what the user has opened up to that portlet, or to the portal. So, for instance, I'm a person that is really interested in vitamins. Then you could picture one of these health websites that will actually customize content based on perhaps the person's diseases that they've entered, allergies that they've had, and people are willing to pay for services like that. Another possibility would be like drug stores, for instance, charging a transaction fee to synchronize somebody's medication list with their personal health record, because there is an advantage to that. People are interested. Using the secure messaging system inside, you'll be able to have messages going between provider and citizen or patient. And it's kind of interesting because that model is already being used in Toronto. There's a company that charge a transaction fee to the end user for the convenience of sending a message to request a refill on medications to their GP, and the GP fills it, and then they pay $25. People are doing this, and they actually have a business model. They're being successful, and why is it? Well, convenience. Good grief! If you had to spend 2.5 hours to drive into Toronto, do your go to the physician, just get this piece of paper, then drive somewhere else and park. Well, people feel that that's worth whatever. I can't remember what the fee was, but $25, for instance. So there's a lot of potential here, and you can probably see that as we start developing this this substrate on the bottom, that industry partners and private companies can actually start building some of these services that sit on top of the PHR architecture, and it will still allow the retention of the privacy and whatnot in the hands of the individual. It's a bit of a paradigm shift, because you'll notice that we're not talking, I think I mentioned a few times the word citizen instead of patient. Patient's an old term, it's medicalized. We're trying to capture the broader population that are still well. And so this is sort of like a citizen service that hopefully, if all goes well within the next 3 to 5 years, is going to become a free service available to every Canadian, with a lot of value-added services sitting on top. So anyway, that's the end of my talk, and Renee will talk just briefly about what Kwanka is, because it's an interesting research project in the engagement of individuals in their own health information. It's only two slides.
Yeah. That's not fast. Okay, I cycle a lot. Every day I cycle about 40 kilometers. I commute from Twist Fences to St. John. So I started collecting my data because I know about this PHR, and I eventually wanted to enter my data in the PHR. And I thought, you know what? I'm making some consciously decision, environmentally friendly decisions. What's stopping me from some of this every mile I make to the industry as a Kyoto, something like that. Who knows? So that's the idea.
Natural gas.
Natural gas. So that's the idea. The fun part, the real fun part, is I've got like a PDA here. I took a mouse, I took it apart, and I welded a little reed switch on it, and I've got a magnet on it, and it seems to be working okay. I've got it connected to the hardware just came in today, so I haven't played with it yet, but I've got it connected to my laptop now, and it can count the ticks. So I'm building an environment. I also want to validate the data with my GPS, because the new iPads you can get has GPS integrated in wireless, so the device is really small. So anyways, I want to do that, and like I was saying, I was counting my mileage and writing it down every day. I did that for about a month, and then I stopped. And now the only thing I do is I check my odometer once in a while to see what's my total. So I'm a bit lazy. I don't want to accumulate my data with much effort. So what I want to do is when I park my bike, I want to determine that there's no activity here, send the data here, and just the data goes into a repository. And maybe I want to know, like, there are RSSPs that get current gas prices. Maybe I want to know, like, how much money I'm saving, Because, like, since August 10th, it's gone up a bit, 1,900 kilometers. So, it's got to be worth something. Okay, so, let's assume this is a business, right? And my whole reason for doing this is I want my group leader to sponsor me for, like, a week long. Field testing. So the idea is this could be anything, right? But we built a little demo half a year ago. I had an IP phone talking to the ping version. So it could be anything, right? Anything could send an XML message up here. So that's the reason why they're kind of interested in this, and they let me play with this a little bit. So what does it look like now? Okay.
You can't see the mouse. It's very small.
You can't. Anyway, the reed switch is here. I got the magnet here. Every time I flip the wheel, I get a tick count here. Maybe I'll get to NRC and my hardware will come and I'll have to go back on the drawing board. But so far it works.
Just put up the last slide.
So you have to do a patch for that yet?
You know what? You're doing the internet. There's a lot of stuff that people are doing with mice. It's amazing. So we didn't know.
Those are blocked though from the NRC. Oh, never mind. Anyway, just in conclusion, I mean, basically, the type of thing and the scale, I don't know whether you can appreciate the scale of this project is. This is unbelievably huge. And in my mind, as a physician, actually, which is kind of, I guess, counterintuitive, but I think that we are going to beat the EMR, the one patient, one record. I think that we're going to beat it in terms of time to market, because one thing that's slowing down a lot of integrated EMR pieces across the country is PIPEDA, the Privacy Act, the new Privacy Act, right, with the exchange of information. This is really neat because this places all the control in the individual's hands. No one's going to break in to sneak around and look at their data. Logs are kept with everything, and the individual can actually go and apply rights and revoke them at any time without penalty. Anyway, so that's that. Unfortunately, we have to go back to St. John's, so we won't be at the Cyber Social, so maybe we could entertain a couple of questions here. And you could take the email addresses if you have further questions beyond this. But do you have any questions?
Is there an issue with, I'm not entirely sure how much or what sorts of data are going to be put in the individual's hands, but my impression is files and various formats that are generated by various pieces of medical equipment are often closed source.
Absolutely.
So your MRI data is not a file format that you're allowed to have.
Well, yes and no. That's a really, really good question. Part of the neat thing about this is that this is coming from the consumer, right? In a way, this is the consumer, and the consumers are going to drive what kind of services and what kind of demand is placed on the system to say, no, 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 I'm a taxpayer, I want my laboratory data to be in my personal health record, period. Well, we're helping that because we're building HL7 interfaces. Well, we can build DICOM interfaces as well. So then you can now have your PHR data inside. The thing is that let's say you are in New Brunswick, you need a service in Ontario, had the MRI done here because they want to save a step. In our department, because we're completely digital, they put it on CD, give it to the patient, and they take it themselves. You've got to remember, one thing that's interesting about legislation in Canada with respect to medical records is that you as an individual actually own the data. It's your data. Yeah, but there's a caveat to that. The media is owned by either the hospital corporation or the physician, and we become the guardians of that information to safekeep that. And that's why we have to keep medical records for 10 years after we cease seeing you, type of thing. In this case, it's a little different, right? So already there are things in place, and there's things changing right away where people are starting to access their own information as they exit the hospital, for instance. You can now go to, on your way out, if you're stuck in hospital, I don't know whether it's true across the whole province, but people are starting to do this in St. John. I want to know, when I leave the hospital, I want a list of everybody who accessed my electronic record. Because a lot of people access records, and they even started to do a little experiment in St. John where they actually put flags on certain people's, like, public figures' accounts to see who's been looking at it, and some people have been fired over it. Privacy is becoming, ironically, privacy is finally becoming something interesting despite the fascination with, like, Big Brother and Survivor and watching people in a box do a rat maze thing, you know what I mean? But yet at the same time we say, no, 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 my privacy is important, but anyway. Anyway, any other questions? Yeah.
Because, you know, one way to look at it with the provider is, you know, single patient, single record, which has got a lot of political challenges and technology challenges in trying to do that. I guess this view is kind of, I guess, multiple records, single view, where the view is my personal health record. And one of the things I didn't hear mentioned, just kind of curious your view on, is really, you know, what that identity is. Who owns that identity? Is it my Medicare card? Is it patient?
Okay.
Who owns my DNA?
That is a very good thing. The identity managed component of this, we, again, are not really endeavoring to govern by any stretch. We're going to make suggestions. And I mentioned that the whole, I mentioned SNB as an example. Because Service New Brunswick actually is quite, it's a one-stop shopping for a lot of integrated government services that require identity management, like your driver's license, your Medicare cards, and everything. Now, in New Brunswick, there's a whole identity management thing going on within the Department of Health and Wellness as well, right? So we are not endeavoring to do that portion, but the neat thing is that with the way the technology is and the way we are providing a mapping, because we have to have a couple of things. We have to have a way of uniquely identifying people, and it needs to be done in a way that is actually very easy for an end user to understand, instead of FF012379, you know, that sort of idea. And so the sort of one of the ways that we're looking at is to use an email-like system. Not an email address system. So that servers could reside in a number of different locations, but you would be so-and-so at, and it could be a number on the left side, but we're not going to govern that. So we are looking at Service New Brunswick as a potential partner to provide that piece so that we can deal. Basically, once you've got a PHR, it is yours and you control it. But to get a PHR, you have to go stand in front of the wicket, get your photo taken, and do the identity portion there with the Service New Brunswick. Any others?
But who owns the identity? That's the question.
Well, that's a good question. You know, in terms of what, though? Like, you own your identity, obviously. You can delete yourself from the system if, well...
Well,
you can go and apply to have yourself deleted from the system if you want. But you
can't really.
Well, why not?
Because the government requires information, right?
No.
The Institute for Health Information Records.
That's information
from us.
But that's medical. Systems. That's medical.
All the time.
This is different. This is non-medical. Well, not non-medical. Medical is a component of it.
There'll be a link between the two.
There could be. But the power is left in the individual. One thing that a lot of people don't realize is that when you're in the hospital, for instance, the discharge diagnosis and stuff becomes a stat that gets sent to Fredericton. Well, you didn't authorize that. That's in the legislation. This is different. This, you own the data that's in the system. Now, there's a whole bunch of issues around that to do with copyright of information coming, say, from a hospital or a clinic. It's easier to implement in Canada where we have a single-payer system than elsewhere. But CIHI is not going to be able to come in here and just root through people's, or CIHR is not going to be able to come through here and go through people's records without them authorizing it. The system is encrypted in a way that prevents that. An individual authority must be granted on a one-to-one document level. Anyway.
The MIT version of this, nothing stopping people from installing their own health record server.
Yeah. Which means we're going to have a million PHR servers in the world. But having said that, that's okay, because what we're working with on an international way is that we're going to create, because maybe groups want to have, you know, there's a whole bunch of different ways, but we need to have a way that is a common talk. I recognize you. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Anyway.
I was just thinking, the analogy might be, I expect I can register myself to Snoopy, report all that I want to run my personal wellness. The moment that I need to link it to something that is full on, I need some kind of registration and needs to record and grant access to that information. The moment that I kind of enters into that larger name of medical records, the one I know who I am, I need to trust you.
Yes and no. If you get a picture, this is going to be a longitudinal project, and that somebody somewhere, some government department possibly, maybe NRC, will house this data for a lifetime. You don't want everybody being able to create count one, count two, count three, count four, count five. So for the purposes of personal health, as it stands, we're still going to be doing focus groups and whatnot with end users to find out if this is going to be the case. But for the purposes of this, you're not anonymous on the system. You can hide on the system, but you're not anonymous. Because that authorship is actually vital with this piece of technology. We need to know who within the system. If institutions have to identify themselves and be authorized to add information to your record, well, so do you. And so within the system, you are going to be identified. But you can keep that identity totally to yourself and never give it out if you want. And then when the time comes, you can give out your identity to allow, and then open your record up a bit for writing, reading, arithmetic, whatever, you know, that sort of thing. But it brings up a good point. But we're going to be asking groups about that, because another problem that came up was, well, what about people who don't trust leaving it on the net? Well, don't use it. You can still go into the bank. You can still, you know what I mean? Like, you can still keep your own PHR if you want. This just might be the next level that will facilitate ease of use with your own health information.
By the way, in the interest of time, I see it's 10 minutes to 5 in the cyber social, because everyone's going to the cyber social, right? It starts at 5 o'clock, and so you have 10 minutes to get there. Don't forget there's a talk on intellectual property and open source licensing. Yes?
one thing. Since my presentation was canceled at the end,
that was the last item on your agenda. If you go to my blog at jarche.com, jarche.com, I put on some information about business models for open source. And if you're interested in carrying on the discussion, there are a lot of other people around here who will engage in that conversation. So if you're interested in how do you make money at this, is it possible, just come to the blog and post your comments or whatever.
And I'd like thank Keith and Vinay and all of the speakers in today. I think they did a tremendous job, and I want to thank you all for coming in.